I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking with an old friend of mine of the Ashbrook Center and guest host, co-host, really, of this podcast, The American Idea, John Mosher, about a really interesting and important topic historically in the history of the United States and really in the history of the world, and that is the end of the Second World War in Europe. Those of you who may not know, John is professor of history at Ashland University. He is a wonderful teacher of courses, including courses on World War II, undergrad and graduate level. He is also a prolific author and has authored a wonderful book on the Great Depression and the coming of the Second World War, a book on American Anglophobia, and continues his work and research on World War II and its consequences and aftermath. John, thanks for being with us again on The American Idea.
Always a pleasure, Jeff.
All right, John, I want to start with this quote, thinking about the end of the war in Europe. I remember this quote from Winston Churchill, and he gives it in a speech, a well-known speech, after the Battle of El Alamein, which he called the Battle of Egypt, in the Eastern Mediterranean, when the British forces turn back Rommel's Africa Corps and essentially get their first big victory of the war, at least according to Churchill. And he says about this victory, he says, "This is not the end. It is not even the beginning of the end, but it is perhaps the end of the beginning." And then he goes on to say, "That's because now the British and the Americans in Europe will be facing the Germans with parity of forces, which we have not had before. Tanks, artillery, air cover, and air fighters and bombers. It's a new war now." That struck me as a really interesting phrase. When people heard it, they loved the turn of phrase. But he says it's not the beginning of the end. If El Alamein is the end of the beginning, when is the beginning of the end for the war in Europe?
Yeah, that's a great question, because obviously there would be a lot of hard fighting between October 1942, the Second Battle of El Alamein, and May of 1945. As of October 1942, the Germans had not been beaten on the Eastern Front yet. Stalingrad would happen a few months later. Nor had U.S. forces found their way into combat in any large sense at that point. And we know that the first occasion when U.S. forces went up against veteran German forces in early 1943, it did not go well for U.S. troops. So there was a whole lot of hard fighting, a whole lot of men dying. So when's the beginning of the end? Certainly not until after not merely the Normandy invasion, but the breakout in Normandy. So sometime in the summer of 1944, I think it's fair to say it's the beginning of the end. Now, even then, there were a lot of people saying, well, this is all wrapped up now. And the Battle of the Bulge in December 1945 showed that they were too premature in promising immediate victory. But certainly by the summer of 1944, there was no reasonable chance that Hitler was going to win the war. It was just a matter of time, really just of closing the noose around Hitler's neck.
The question that comes to me based on what you're saying there, I'm really struck by the idea of, you know, everyone, as you say, and we talked about this with the Battle of the Bulge, the assumption was, well, now that we've landed in Europe in mid of 44, now that we're pushing on at the end of 44, it's just a matter of time. There's nothing left to do. The victory is inevitable, but war is never inevitable. You just don't know what's going to happen, right? Did the war in Europe end the way it was inevitably going to end? If you say 1944 is the beginning of the end, or are there unexpected twists and turns, maybe for good or ill, based on the decisions that leaders made?
Yeah, I think that that's certainly the case, especially when you consider the dynamics of the Grand Alliance, the United States, Great Britain, and the Soviet Union, and how much, in terms of planning for the post-war world, was still unresolved at the beginning of 1945. The Yalta Conference, the big three had met before at Tehran. Churchill and Stalin had met on numerous occasions. But a lot of the hardest questions concerning what's going to happen after the war, the can was kept getting kicked down the road. FDR in particular was saying, let's not have difficult conversations now because they could jeopardize Allied unity. But February 1945 comes along and you can't really kick the can much longer. Everybody is pretty much assuming the end of the war in Europe is probably within 6 months away. So decisions have to be made at this point, decisions that had not been made in late 1944. So if you ask about things that were unexpected, the Battle of the Bulge, absolutely. The Western Allies did not see that German offensive coming. The attitude among the Allied high command was that German forces in the West were spent. They no longer could mount a major offensive, and they were absolutely incorrect about that. I think the German war effort in the East was tended to be underestimated by the Soviets as well. If you look at the period from January to early May 1945, when the surrender came, right, this five-month period, Soviet losses were somewhere on the order of 775,000 men. Now, the U.S. and U.S. and British forces combined were something like 75,000.
Yeah, that's a staggering number.
It really was. So the way the Germans were doggedly defending, much more so in the East than they were in the West, and there were also some pretty big mistakes on the part of the Soviets. That was unexpected.
All right, take us then to you mentioned the Yalta Conference. Take us to the Yalta Conference. I know many of our listeners who are historically minded and learned have heard of it. They may know something of it, but remind us of what it was, when it happened, and why it's so significant thinking about the end of the war.
Sure. So it's early February 1945. It is the second of only two occasions in which FDR, Stalin, and Churchill would be in the same room together. The first was the Tehran Conference in November of 1943. The so-called Big Three would meet again at Potsdam in July of 1945, but by then FDR was dead and Truman was representing the United States. Also, interesting fact, in the middle of the Potsdam Conference, Churchill learned that he was voted out as prime minister, so he had to go home and Clement Attlee had to come and replace him. So Yalta is, again, only the second time that these three men had met together. And there were a lot of issues that had come up before that where no real decisions had been made. For example, there was no more taxing question than this. What's going to happen to Poland? We'll see how far you want to get into the weeds of this question. But in 1939, when Poland had fallen to the Germans, those government leaders who were lucky enough to get out of the country eventually made it to London. And they called themselves the Polish government in exile. And all of the Allies recognized them. They said, okay, when the war is over, when Poland has been liberated, they're going to go back and resume things. Well, in 1943, Stalin decided that he no longer wanted to recognize the so-called London Poles. If you want to talk about why, I'm happy to do so, but simply withdrew. It claimed that they were in bed with the Germans, which was ludicrous, and said, well, we've got these Poles here, Polish communists who had fled to Moscow in 1939. We think they would be a good post-war government for Poland. So what's the Polish government going to be was a huge problem, because on the one hand, you had the United States and to a great extent, Great Britain as well, saying this war is supposed to be about self-determination. It's a key part of the Atlantic Charter, what this war is supposed to be about. Peoples are able to choose the kind of government under which they by which they are ruled. The Soviet argument was Poland is too important for our national security. Poland is just a big flat plain between Germany and us. We've been invaded through Poland repeatedly in history, and we have a right to have a friendly government. And the position of the West was, of course, you have a right to a friendly government, but they also have the right to self-determination. Well, FDR and Churchill were sort of deluding themselves because left to their own devices, the Poles were not going to elect a pro-Soviet government. So this was a huge issue that had to be resolved. The treatment of Germany was another huge issue that had to be resolved. What role France would play in the post-war world, another big issue. The status of the Balkan states, some details about the structure of the United Nations, although the San Francisco conference had already laid out the essentials, but there was a lot more that needed to be done on that as well. So all of this was unsettled as of the beginning of 1945.
So on those issues, Poland, France, Germany, the Balkans, the UN, those are huge issues thinking about the end of the war and what's really going to become of Europe in the future. What, if anything, was decided at Yalta on those issues?
Yeah, so France was going to have an important role. It would get a zone of occupation in Germany at the expense of the British and American zones. None of Stalin's zone was going to go to the French. He never would have allowed that. And France would be a permanent member of the Security Council, along with China. So that was resolved. So that's the UN. And another thing that was decided on at Yalta regarding the UN: the permanent members of the Security Council would have veto power on every issue. There were some at Yalta who said they should not be able to veto things that concern their own country. But both Stalin and Churchill were keen that there would be a veto on every subject. This is one of the few times where it was Stalin and Churchill against Roosevelt, rather than Roosevelt and Churchill against Stalin.
The people who are there, the three who are there, of course, it's late in FDR's life. What do we know from people who were there at Yalta, or what FDR, Stalin, or Churchill said later? What do we know about their personal relationships with each other and how much that actually affected the end of the war and the post-war settlement?
The attitude at Yalta was, we have to make this work, right? at any cost. So there was a great willingness to compromise on all sorts of questions. If the Russians seemed to come out ahead at Yalta, it's because they had some important cards to play. Number one, their armies, the Red Army, was already in occupation of Eastern Europe, and everybody understood there was no way to get them out short of war. So even when agreements were being made regarding Poland, yeah, there was some language in there about a coalition government of London Poles and Lublin Poles, who were these communist Poles that Stalin liked. There would be a coalition government of them that would hold elections, and then the elections would be free and fair elections in which all Democratic and anti-Nazi parties could participate. Sounded great. The thing is, who would get to decide which parties were sufficiently democratic and anti-Nazi? Well, of course, it was going to be the Soviets, since the Red Army was there. That was understood at the conference. So after the conference takes place, the London Poles after Poland has been fully liberated, the London Poles come back, and Stalin invites them for consultation in Moscow, which is never a good thing. They're imprisoned. In fact, the Soviets very brutally suppress any thought that Poland is going to be anything but communist, and this helps lead directly into the Cold War. I don't want to suggest that Poland was the only issue, but it was the single biggest issue. Remember, FDR's dead in April 1945. Truman, who wasn't at Yalta, is president. He's looking at the Yalta Accords, the decisions that were made. Wait a minute, where's this stuff about free elections? And there are no free elections happening. Stalin is imposing a Soviet regime on them. And Truman is protesting again and again. Some members of his cabinet who were at Yalta said, well, you could interpret this language many ways. It's not as clear as you think that the Soviets are violating. But Truman could not be convinced.
So out of that arrangement, then, where the Soviets are already and occupied most of Eastern Europe, the Americans, the Allies, the British, the French have gotten mostly to Berlin. And as you say, by April or getting close to there in April of 1945, the end of the war itself, where are the forces and how does the war actually end?
Yeah. Okay. So at Yalta, the Soviets were in control of almost all of Poland by this time, and at certain points were on German soil. The Allies in the West had liberated France and most of Belgium, and were also on German soil at particular points. One of the questions that come up at Yalta is, how is Berlin to be taken? And the Western Allies, Stalin wants the honor of having the Red Army occupy Berlin. And neither Churchill nor FDR is going to say no to him at this point. But what ends up happening is the Red Army moves at a snail's pace in February, March, April, and finally it's late April that they get to Berlin. Meanwhile, effective German resistance in the West has essentially broken down, and the British and U.S. and French forces are sweeping east. And there's some talk, well, why don't we help out with the liberation of Berlin? Eisenhower says, no, that's not a good idea. It was agreed at Yalta that the Soviets were going to do it. Plus, we know what the division of Germany is going to be after the war. Berlin is entirely within the proposed Soviet zone of occupation. So even if we moved in and occupied that territory, we were just going to have to leave again. So there was one location where U.S. At Torgau, where U.S. and Soviet troops linked up along the river, the Elbe there. And there was a big party and they shook hands and everything. But there was no effort on the part of the Western Allies to help the Soviets take Berlin because Stalin would not hear of it. And instead, U.S. forces swept south because Eisenhower was led to believe that the Germans were intending a last-ditch defense, that Hitler himself and his key right-hand men had moved down to Berchtesgaden, to the Eagle's Nest there, and he had established an Alpine redoubt, a big fortress where all of the best German forces were being kept to keep the fight going for as long as possible. It turned out that was completely mythical. There was no Alpine redoubt. U.S. forces got there. Anybody who's seen Band of Brothers knows about this. They go to Berchtesgaden. It's completely undefended. So they sweep through. Hitler, by this time, has already shot himself in the bunker below the chancellery. So the war ends, but it ends with the Soviets in Berlin. The Western forces are not there.
What about on the German side in the end of the war? You mentioned, of course, Hitler committing suicide, but what happens not only to German armed resistance, but German elites, German leaders, maybe the German general staff? What's their disposition and their conduct at the closing months and at the end of the war?
So on the one hand, the official Nazi position was that every German male anyway, was responsible for taking up arms and resisting. So you have little kids and old men being pressed into service. So it's really pathetic. They didn't have any training. They're just rushed into what is essentially a meat grinder. Meanwhile, the Red Army as it advances through Berlin, is committing an orgy of rape and looting and burning and murder. It really is horrifying. On the other hand, while there is all of these calls for sacrifice and fighting to the bitter end for the German people, a lot of the leading figures of the regime are looking for a way out. Now, Hitler, obviously not. Hitler was saying, they're never going to take me, and he ends his life. Same with Goebbels. But Himmler and Goering are both trying to work something out. And they know they can work. They're not going to be able to work out anything with the Russians. So they start making contact with the British and the Americans. And this doesn't get anywhere. Of course, the British Americans are concerned that that the Soviets are going to look at any kind of conversations like these as bad faith. So they're not even entertained. But you do have large numbers of Germans moving from the east to the west because they realize they're going to be better treated by the British and the Americans than they're going to be treated by the Soviets.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
And the regime itself, for our listeners, we know years later of the Nuremberg trials, but the regime itself and leading figures, how does the war end for them?
Well, the Himmler and Goering are taken into custody, as is most.
They surrender or they're captured?
They go to negotiate, but then they're taken into custody of it. Well, you know, whether it's a surrender or not, I don't think it's entirely clear. But they know the war is over, and they're looking to get the best deal they can for themselves. So you could call that a surrender, and it's before the German army officially surrenders, which is several days after Hitler's death. By the way, Himmler and Goering were already making these advances before Hitler's death, so that in Hitler's last will and testament, he reads them out of the movement and says that they are traitors to Germany, and he lays out who the cabinet of Germany is going to be after his death, and these are all men whose loyalty he believes are absolute, and Himmler and Goering are not part of it.
At this point, before Hitler's dead, are there any further conspiracies? Of course, there have been conspiracies against Hitler among leading figures in Germany prior to this. But toward the end of the war, do people start saying, look, this is madness. We need to sue for peace. We need peace overtures. We need to get rid of Hitler so we can try to save Germany somehow. Or are they just completely under Hitler's thrall?
The reaction to the July 1944 attempt on Hitler's life, Operation Valkyrie, was really a Nazi purge of the army and, to a lesser extent, the civil service. Anybody whose absolute loyalty to Hitler was questioned was removed or often killed. Erwin Rommel was a classic example of this. There's no real evidence that Rommel was involved in the conspiracy, or if he was, it was extremely tangential, probably not even that. But he was forced to commit suicide on suspicion that his loyalty to Hitler was less than perfect. The result of that was kind of a National Socialist radicalization of the war. The war became more ideological from July 1944 until May of 1945. Any kind of attempt to criticize the war effort was seen as an example of disloyalty. People were ordinary Berliners who complained about the war would be shot. So no, the answer to your question is no. There is no real resistance, except the example of guys like Himmler or Goering who decide, I'm just going to see what deal I can get from the Americans.
Right. So, and the most radical Nazis, most fanatical Nazis are left. It's interesting. We usually think the opposite. It's most fanatical at the beginning of the war and it wanes, but you're saying that's an interesting point, right? They become more radical, more radicalized, because they're the ones who are left. And it leads me to think, of course, at the end of the war, the Americans, and I think the Soviets too, the armies, as they're conquering, come across concentration camps. Yeah. What is the status of the Nazi concentration camps and the Holocaust toward the end of the war?
The very worst of the camps, Auschwitz, for example, was the classic case. The five or six that were called Vernichtungslager, the extermination camps, they were liberated by the Red Army. But the camps, there were thousands of camps. This has to be mentioned. And horrible, horrible stuff happened at all of them. Those five or six extermination camps existed for the purpose of mechanized slaughter. These other concentration camps weren't, but still, people died in large numbers. So you had, again, if you've seen Band of Brothers, you see the reaction that these U.S. soldiers have when they liberate, what is that, Buchenwald? It is the one that they liberate in Band of Brothers. And they're absolutely shocked by what they see there. All these skeletons of men, people recently died and dying, continuing to die even after they had been liberated. And this led to a certain amount of rage. And it led to the question, how could Germans have not known that this was happening? They had to have. And to this day, there's debate about this, to what extent ordinary Germans knew this.
By the time you get then to May, and the armies have come together, the even linked up, as you say, at one point, the Soviet and the Allied armies, it looks like the Allies have accomplished their aim of unconditional surrender. By the time you get Hitler's suicide and the complete collapse of the Nazi regime. But it raised the question in my mind, so it looks like they accomplished their goal. But is it fair to ask, maybe at least from the American and British point of view, what didn't the Allies accomplish at the end of the war that they wanted to accomplish?
I think that they had hoped that post-war Germany could be administered jointly by the great powers until the great powers, the Allies, deemed the Germans ready for self-government again. That was the intent. At Yalta, it was decided there's going to be an Allied control council, right? The four powers were going to have their zones of occupation, but those were just to do day-to-day administration in various parts of the country. Overall administration of Germany was to be handled by an Allied control council made up of a representative of each of the four occupying powers. And in fact, for almost a year, the Allied control council operated pretty effectively to set common policies. But as the Cold War started to develop, as tensions grew between East and West, the Allied Control Council couldn't agree to anything. Right? Eventually it just stopped meeting because it wasn't accomplishing anything. And in practice, it was the occupation authorities in the individual zones that carried out the occupation. This meant that the occupation and the rehabilitation of Germany was handled differently in different parts of the country. And of course, you know, once there was a West Germany and an East Germany, then this distinction became totally institutionalized.
And of course, there's ferocious debate among Americans, I'm sure more broadly, about how to treat Germany when the war is over. Some people are saying, let's look at the lessons of World War I. Let's not repeat those lessons. But people drew different lessons from World War I and how it should apply to Germany at the end of the war.
Yeah, absolutely. So on the one hand, you say, well, if the problem was that the Treaty of Versailles was too harsh, right, and it made the Germans just so unwilling to live up to the terms of the treaty, then that's bad. On the other hand, if the critique is Versailles was too weak, so it allowed Germany within 10 years to be an industrial powerhouse again, which it was, then maybe you want to go toward being harsher. In fact, I think there are pretty strong arguments on both sides. My dictum on Versailles, for what it's worth, is it was really spiteful toward Germany in ways that are less important. So saying the Germans have the sole blame for the war. Well, okay, did you really have to include that? On the other hand, there was really nothing in the treaty that kept Germany from bouncing back very quickly. So you had the worst of both worlds, a German people that was outraged by the treaty that were populating one of the world's most important industrial nations. So there was a determination to avoid the lessons of Versailles, or to learn the lessons of Versailles, but it wasn't entirely clear what those lessons were. And in the end, the developing Cold War had an influence on this, because at a certain point, you're asking, is Germany a defeated enemy, or is it a potential friend in this new war? And by the way, the Soviets were looking at East Germany that same way. So denazification is a classic example. Everybody agreed, we're going to get the top Nazis out, we're going to put them on trial, We're going to purge government of these people. But the thing is, there were millions and millions of Nazis. Is every single Nazi somebody that is responsible for atrocities and has to be kept out? For all the talk of denazification, there were plenty of former Nazis that made their way into high positions in the civil service and the government, both in the East and in the West.
And the German material condition at the end of the war, certainly at the end of the First World War, it's largely intact, because there isn't the sort of total war that happens, for example, the incredible Allied bombing of Germany. What's the situation with Germany's material condition? If their political condition is they're divided up in these zones, and East and West are they're vying for the alliance and use of the halves of Germany. Yeah. What's Germany like? Is it a totally shattered country?
Yeah, it really is. It's got virtually, because of the effects of aerial bombardment, but also normal effects of land-based war, there was almost no industrial capacity left in the country. The Germans were being fed through the charity of the Allies for the first months of the war. And it really wasn't until, after the Marshall Plan goes into effect that you start to see real improvements in Germany. And you do see in the 1950s the so-called Wirtschaftswunder, the economic miracle that Germany bounces back from this. But yeah, the contrast with 1919 couldn't be sharper. Germany was in possession of really an untouched industrial plan. Some of that was taken under the terms of Versailles, but Germany was not a ruined country industrially in 1919.
As a historian who's studied the war and studied the end of the war and the beginning of the Cold War, I'm always fascinated, I know our listeners are, by sort of insights that we get from history and from studying this. If you look at the end of the war in Europe, what are your top lessons or insights that you glean from it?
We benefit today from the hindsight that relations between the West and the Soviet Union were going to deteriorate quickly. As hard as it is for us to wrap our minds around it, the men who came away from Yalta in 1945 really believed that they had reached an agreement that was going to allow for lasting cooperation. Had there been, by the way, one of the few people who understood that was not the case was George Kennan, the chargé d'affaires at the U.S. chargé d'affaires at the U.S. embassy in the Soviet Union. Kennan was saying, "Look, we have to cooperate with the Soviets because Nazi Germany is much, much worse. However, let's not kid ourselves about the nature of the Soviet regime. We are not going to have long-term friendly relations with the Soviets, and we should keep that in mind in all of our approach." Kennan, I think, was right. Arrangements that were established on the assumption that there was going to be post-war cooperation were probably naive. What would a different solution have looked like? I have a hard time spinning that out. I think there was a lot of wishful thinking in early 1945 that would ultimately be disappointed.
So the clash of ideologies, the clash of national interests was just so strong. But in the attempt to cooperate, people overlooked those permanent primordial facts.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the argument that it's all about ideology is overblown. The U.S. and Soviet communism could have, because the United States had no intention of supplanting Soviet communism, but Stalin's idea, which Kennan always said was based not even so much on communism, but on a traditional set Russian sense of insecurity, that Russia must keep expanding or it's going to start decaying. That is a more pertinent factor than simply communist ideology. But the fact is, there was not an attempt on the part of most U.S. leaders to understand what Stalin was really like and what his beliefs were for the post-war world.
So, John, as the Allies are closing in militarily, of course, the Germans have been at work on a number of technological innovations in military hardware, things like the jet, the V-1, the V-2 rockets. And, of course, the Allies, at least, are hard at work on the atomic bomb. What role did technological development play in the end of the war?
Yeah, it's a tremendous role. I mean, you look at the technology of 1945 and compare it to the technology of 1939 when the war began, and there's a huge difference. Hitler was fascinated with technology. What Hitler suffered from was the fact that the German economy was much, much smaller than the U.S. economy or even the British economy. And Hitler had so many technological dreams, he had a hard time focusing on any particular one. So there were all kinds of projects that surface and are good fodder for History Channel documentaries to this day. Like, was he building flying saucers or something like that? But absolutely, jet technology, rocket technology were all things that Germany was highly invested in. On the U.S. side, of course, there was lots of interest in technology, but it is impressive to what extent the focus was really on the development of that one thing, the atomic bomb. Yes, technologically, the aircraft, the tanks that the Allies were using improved steadily over the course of the war. But when you talk about, you know, pivotal new developments, the focus is really on the atomic bomb. Whereas the Germans tried to go in many directions at once, and that's fortunate for us that was the case.
Yeah. Did that advanced German technology, to the extent they did development in things like rockets and jets, did that have much of an actual military effect?
No, because Hitler was always fascinated with the idea that the war is going to be turned around through a sudden, unexpected offensive. He was not interested in defending. When he was forced to make decisions about defense, he was actually terrible at it. He would issue orders like, well, don't retreat. Okay, fine. He was always, so Battle of the Bulge in this light makes absolute sense from Hitler's perspective. What Hitler thought was going to be accomplished by the Battle of the Bulge, you know, getting up to Antwerp and splitting the U.S. and British from one another, was a pipe dream. It wasn't going to happen. The V-1 and V-2, amazing that at this stage in the war, Hitler says, how are we going to win it? We're going to kill more people in London. It could never really turn the tide. Jet fighters. Look, the ME-262 was a great, great plane that was delayed for months because Hitler said, we have to find a way to strap bombs on it so we can attack London. His scientific advisor said, really, mein Führer, this is meant to be a fighter. But using it as a fighter, and it was an extremely effective fighter. When it went into action against U.S. planes and British planes, it did a lot of damage, but it was never developed in large enough numbers to make a difference, mainly because Hitler for months had been saying we needed to be a bomber.
John, before we go, there are so many of our listeners who will be interested to know about really great books on the end of the war, and maybe even, you've already mentioned Band of Brothers, but maybe even some TV shows or movies that they or their students could take a look at. What books and other resources do you recommend on the end of the war in Europe?
Well, gosh, you can't go wrong with Band of Brothers, especially those last episodes cover the final months of the war really, really dramatically. In terms of a book, The best I can recommend is by Ian Kershaw, K-E-R-S-H-A-W. He is a popular historian. He wrote a book called The End, which is about the roughly the last year of Nazi Germany and how it and how it managed to hold on is a little bit amazing.
Winston Churchill, of course, after he's prime minister, he writes a history of World War II, which is a terrific read. And your book on World War II is really good, but Churchill's is really, really good.
Fair.
That helps to be there, I guess. But one thing that he said about not the end of the war, but the beginning of the war, and he called it the unnecessary war. But when you look back and you look at the end of the war, is that judgment validated?
Well, when Churchill said it was an unnecessary war, he meant that had more effort been made to stop Hitler in the mid to late 1930s, which, by the way, Churchill believed could have been done with the help of the Soviet Union as well, that you would not have ended up with the behemoth Germany that overran Europe from 1939 to 1941. That Hitler could have been stopped over the Sudetenland. That Hitler could have been stopped from occupying Austria. Hitler could have been stopped from marching his forces into the Rhineland in 1936. It's important. As great a work of literature as Churchill's History of the Second World War is, it's important to remember that this is Churchill trying to make himself look good. The fact is, he only really emerged as a huge critic of appeasement after the Munich Conference. All of these other things that he wrote about, he was playing nice with Chamberlain at that point, and wasn't really. And before him, Baldwin. He didn't really want to ruffle feathers. But then he went into open opposition only after Munich. And then he writes in this book like he had always been involved in it. But yeah, whether Churchill's alternate strategy would have worked is impossible to say. But sure sounds good.
Well, it's certainly a fascinating story and such an incredibly important thing for us to remember the end of the war in Europe. VE Day, John, thanks again for taking the time, as always, to join us on The American Idea.
My pleasure, Jeff.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.